Hello and welcome to NACLA Radio. This is our spring 2012 podcast. We are your hosts, Michael Fox,
Alexandra Hall,
and Amber Ozano.
Here at NACLA, we've been busy over the last few months. Our November-December 2011 issue was on Latino student movements, covering the Dream Movement, the Chilean Student Movement, the Occupy Movement, and the Unidos Youth Movement to stop the Tucson, Arizona School Board from closing their beloved Mexican-American Studies program. The issue is available online at NACLA.org. We'll be covering more on these themes throughout the program with an exclusive interview with University of Arizona professor Nolan Cabrera on Unidos. We speak with Eric Forsyth of Occupy Birmingham, where activists are taking on the issue of immigration and standing up against the detention of immigrants.
Over the next half hour, we'll also be discussing the legacies of war in Central America, and particularly in Honduras, since the 2009 coup against President Manuel Zelaya. This is the topic of NACLA's next issue, Central America, Legacies of War, which came out the third week of March. In the 1980s, Central America sank deep into political turmoil amid civil wars, brutal military dictatorships, and U.S. intervention. Three decades later, the legacies of these wars are still unfolding. Honduras is reliving its history of military coups, repression, and impunity. In Guatemala, a former dictator is charged with genocide. Across the region, former guerrillas and generals are in power. The military is again taking a disturbingly prominent role in police, and communities are defending their land from powerful interests.
Before Central America, however, we go to the University of Arizona, Tucson, where NACLA Radio co-host and blogger Todd Miller interviewed Professor Nolan Cabrera earlier this year about the radical youth organization Unidos and the fight to save Mexican-American studies in Tucson schools. Cabrera co-wrote an article on the Unidos student struggle in the November-December NACLA issue, highlighting how the group successfully shut down two Tucson school board meetings that would have banned Mexican-American studies. Despite the youth and community resistance, the Tucson School Board announced on January 10th that it would officially discontinue the program. In this interview, Cabrera discusses the aftermath of the decision to ban Mexican-American studies, including how administrators removed books from classrooms, instigating massive student walkouts and a feisty conflict over ethnic studies in Arizona.
The Unidos students, the students who took over the board meeting on April 26th, they had a press conference before the board meeting. They said it's going to come down 4-1, but we're not. But the struggle is not over yet, which was funny because they had literally all of the local television coverage was there at their feet, asking them questions, putting the microphone, give me a statement, talk to me about. There's, you know, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 year old, you know, for lack of a better non-patronizing term, there are kids out there doing this. What did they do? They called it 4-1, foregone conclusion. Boom. Program immediately suspended. What happened subsequently is it's kind of hard to determine at this point. What we do know is that the high school students were extremely upset and walked out. I believe it's at Choya High School. I can't remember if that's the correct one. They actually walked out in the subsequent days and converged on the TUSD headquarters.
How many students are you talking about?
Oh, goodness. There's well over 100 students who actually made the march. I'm not sure exactly how many.
And they were actually in the school in class?
And then left. Exactly. Mm-hmm. There were students at Wakefield Middle School who staged a sit-in in the administrative office. While this was going on, there was a directive by the TUSD administration to remove the controversial materials from the courses. So during the school day, during the school session, people went into the classrooms and physically removed the what's now being known as the banned books list, 500 Years of Chicano History, Rethinking Columbus, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and removed them, boxed them up, and put them into some sort of a repository for the books.
And they did this right in front of the students?
In front of the students. And so It's really interesting because the district says, well, we don't ban books. But if you physically take the books away from the students that they're learning in class, and you're telling their instructors that they can't teach them, that becomes a de facto book banning. But what's difficult for me is I think it's a little bit more insidious than that. Because, for example, former Mexican-American studies teachers can no longer teach Henry David Thoreau's Civil Disobedience. But students throughout in the more affluent, whiter parts of the district still have that opportunity. And so it's even, that's why I say it's even more insidious, because it's saying that the specific knowledge in certain students and certain teachers' hands is dangerous, but it's not uniformly applied. And so that, I mean, that's why it's absolutely crazy. And I mean, they've even released a statement, the TOSD administration has released a statement saying, we didn't ban any books. You're technically correct. You didn't ban any books. You just made them incredibly inaccessible, physically removed them from the student view, didn't necessarily replace them in the library, have them boxed up in an area where no one has access to them. But you didn't technically ban books. In addition, the Mexican-American Studies teachers, from what I have heard from them directly, have been directed not to avoid controversial subject matter. Curtis Acosta has a very good interview with Jeff Biggers to this effect. Uh-huh. Avoid controversial subject matter.
Controversial subject matter being
I mean, it's the same way as 2281. It's like, yeah. What does that mean?
Yeah.
But you know, in reality, it's you know, issues of race, racism, oppression. Mm-hmm. You know, basically, you know, the in a weird way, the controversy arrives at the controversy stems from actually teaching historical and contemporary fact. Mm. I mean, that's if you can't teach about oppression, which is a contemporary reality, you can't teach facts. And if we can't teach the facts, how can we actually address them? Yeah, exactly. In addition to that, a lot of the pedagogical practices that were so effective at engaging students, Unity Clap, in La Quech, the teachers have been directed not to to use these in class. There have been reports of monitors actually sporadically being deployed to the classes themselves to make sure that teachers are in compliance.
Monitors? What does that mean?
People to make...
Actual people?
Actual, enforcers? Yeah. Actual people to see, are you teaching anything that's out
there? Wow.
And so, obviously, people are extraordinarily upset about that for good reason. And so when the students did walk out and converged on it at TUSD, God, when was that? I want to say it was like maybe January 15th or 16th or something like that. It was really interesting because and extremely telling in terms of the ideology of the administration of TUSD, because the students walk out, they converge on the building, and they're really upset. They're going, you know. And Dr. Lupita Garcia, who is oversees Mexican American Studies, came out to address the students. And one of the things that she told them, keep in mind, this is the person who oversees Mexican American Studies. She says that discrimination based upon skin color doesn't exist. And if you want to learn the history of Mexico, maybe you should go learn it in Mexico.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, this is a Latina administrator who's putting this forward. And then she says that, you know, if you really, really, the way that people discriminate in this country is based upon ability. And the only thing that's holding you back right now is your ability. And if you want to increase your ability, you need to go back to school. This was what she met them with, and they were upset. They were, you know, even some graduates of the Mexican American Studies joined in that march and said, "This is disrespectful to what it is that I have learned."
We now go to Honduras, where freelance journalist Tim Russo recently filed this report for Free Speech Radio News.
In Honduras, family members continue to demand answers after a prison fire killed more than 350 people. On Monday, relatives broke into a morgue demanding their loved ones' remains. Many Hondurans are also questioning a second fire that erupted over the weekend at the country's largest outdoor market in Tegucigalpa. No one was killed, but many vendors now lack a place to sell their goods. The fires are just the latest disasters to hit the country with the highest homicide rate in the world. Human rights in the country have declined since the 2009 coup, and one of the most violent regions is the Bajo Aguan. There, at least 64 farm workers, or campesinos, have been killed over the last 2 years because of complex land conflicts with the country's wealthiest landowner, Miguel Facuse. Over the weekend, more than 1,400 campesinos, indigenous people, and their allies met to continue their efforts to fight repression. From Tocoa, Honduras, FSRN's Tim Russo reports.
Activists organized the international gathering in solidarity with Honduras to expose the rampant violations of human rights and the systematic killing of campesinos. For months, campesinos have been struggling for land rights as agricultural corporations take over more land. The fight is centered around Miguel Facuse and his agrofuels Dinant Corporation, as well as the Standard Fruit Company. Speaking to the crowd, Melissa Cardosa, with the Convergence of Popular Movements in the Americas, read from the gathering's declaration about the state of human rights in Honduras.
The war in Honduras has been furiously unleashed since the coup d'etat is manifested with assassination, persecution, the criminalization of organized actions, kidnappings, sexual violence towards women, intentional crimes that terrorize the children that live in the villages of campesinos in struggle, attacks against the grassroots media, imprisonment, exile, and lately, arson attacks against the distinct populations of the country.
One of the objectives of the gathering was to launch an international solidarity brigade, which would observe human rights abuses in the Bajo Aguan region. In this vast valley, landowners like Facuse grow African palm, which is then processed and made into cooking oils and biodiesel. Consuela Castillas used to work on one of Facuse's African palm plantations. The middle-aged campesina, who was born in the Bajo Aguan, eventually began organizing with the Unified Campesino Movement of the Aguan, both to secure land rights and to fight for the health of workers. Castilla herself suffers from chronic asthma from years of working with toxic chemicals used in palm production. She says the threats against activists like herself have been increasing.
For approximately 8 months, there's been a continuous persecution by the private security forces of Miguel Facuse towards my house and my daughters, where they live in Corlazita. There's been a constant and daily monitoring of my daughters and a persecution towards them when they leave for school.
In addition to private security forces, the state military presence in Honduras and the Aguan specifically has increased since President Porfirio Lobo took office in 2010. Activists say this has increased the harassment of communities challenging the vast monocrop fiefdom run by Facuse. Salvador Zuniga works with the Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras. He says the death threats are an everyday occurrence for environmentalists and campesinos who inhabit many biologically diverse regions of Honduras.
I think that it's important that the world knows about the constant violation of human rights in our country continues and has become quite acute. It is good that people know about this, but also that they plan actions to be executed in defense of our human rights in a country that is becoming characterized by violence and repression, and in particular in the sector of Bajo Aguan, where a daily occurrence is the detention of men and women campesinos as well as their assassinations.
La realidad que se está viviendo en el país.
In addition to international human rights groups, some U.S. lawmakers have also expressed concerns about the violence in Honduras. Late last year, Congressmember Howard Berman wrote to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton expressing his concern about the systematic violations of human rights and killings of campesinos in Honduras. Berman and other lawmakers want the State Department to withhold military aid until human rights improve. But Annie Byrd, co-director of the Washington, D.C.-based Rights Action, says there has been little response from the Obama administration to the growing violence. She says that could be due to geopolitical interests and the expanding U.S. military presence in Honduras.
The U.S. has a very direct military presence in the Aguan and, of course, in Honduras in general. While it is true that the government of Honduras has completely collapsed, there's no justice system, the police are part of organized crime, the military is part of organized crime. You know, the conclusion that's being drawn from that is, well, then the U.S. needs to militarize more, have a direct military presence, the DEA acting directly in the region. And then also we need to create new police forces for Honduras, that the U.S. needs to do that, when that is absolutely the wrong answer to what's happening. More militarization will not change the situation or solve any problem.
The campesinos' fight for land rights is starting to achieve some results. Last Friday, a group of farm workers signed an agreement with President Porfirio Lobo, which would give land titles to campesinos for close to 20,000 acres of land over the next 15 years. But some have criticized the latest agreement, which includes a 6% interest rate on the payment of the lands. Activists are also demanding an end to detentions of labor leaders and the harassment of families. Tim Russo, FSRN, Tocoa, Honduras.
For a deeper analysis of the current situation in Honduras, we speak with Jenny Atley, a longtime Central America solidarity activist who worked for Witness for Peace in Nicaragua in the 1980s and has been in Central America ever since. She now works for the Nicaragua U.S. Friendship Office, coordinating the Honduras Accompaniment Project. Since the 2009 Honduran coup, her organization has led 12 delegations to the country.
In Honduras today, there's this whole sort of hidden apparatus which is carrying out a dirty war that is targeting people for political assassination, and it's not clear where it's coming from. And so that makes it very dangerous. In addition, there's this overlay of drug trafficking and organized crime, which in some ways doesn't, is a whole unknown in terms of how to navigate it, and it changes all the rules of the game. In the 1980s, one of the things that in some ways created a political space for groups like Witness for Peace and others to work in the region was the fact that U.S. was providing massive amounts of military aid and equipment to wage these counterinsurgency wars. And what we saw in Nicaragua was, while it was acceptable for Nicaraguan casualties to mount, it was not okay for U.S. citizens to be harmed. We saw this in the case, tragically, of Ben Linder, who was the first U.S. citizen to be murdered in Nicaragua. He was a water engineer working on a hydro project up in the mountains to create hydroelectrical energy, and he was murdered by the Contra. And the fallout from that murder was huge in the United States, because there was a huge solidarity movement, and the government heard from that solidarity movement very loud and clear that this was yet another impact of U.S. policy. And it was very clear that after that, the United States was very cautious about making sure that there were not U.S. casualties, because it was too politically costly in the United States. And right now in Honduras, with all of these other layers of violence, some of those dynamics are not as clear. It can be much less clear who the violence is coming from or where it's coming from. There's ways for it to be very confusing. The other thing that's very different today is that the resistance movements in the 1980s in Central America, after many years of exhausting all efforts and mechanisms for change, many of them, at least sectors of them, had adopted armed struggle as a way for social change. And so that armed sector also provided some counterbalance to the violence of the military. And in this current context, the popular movements and the resistance in general in the region, and particularly in Honduras, is by choice choosing nonviolence as a method of social change. So they are totally vulnerable and unprotected. In some ways, you know, it's 30 years later. In some ways, the patterns and policies and structures that create economic injustice and concentrate wealth and power, and the policies that promote that, are still very much in place and the same. And they continue to generate dynamics of extreme poverty and human suffering, and people organize and they try to find solutions and try to resist and create a better reality, and the response is repression and an attempt to criminalize those efforts to improve the situation of the poor.
On March 8th, NACLA attended Movement for Justice in El Barrio's annual International Women's Day event to celebrate rebellious women throughout the world who challenged the effects of unjust neoliberal policies. Groups like Women Occupying Wall Street, Code Pink, and Filipinas for Rights and Empowerment participated in a discussion about the importance of women organizers. Attendees also watched video messages sent in solidarity from women fighting domestic violence in Greece, Zapatista women in Chiapas, and Egyptian women who struggled for revolution in Tahrir Square. Movement for Justice in El Barrio was founded December 2004 by 15 women in East Harlem, many of them Mexican immigrants who had never been politically active. They now have 700 members who are organizing against the gentrification of East Harlem. They consider unwarranted evictions to be a second displacement after the North American Free Trade Agreement forced them to migrate from Mexico to the United States. At the event, NACLA sat down with Movement for Justice in El Barrio's Maria Mercado, who talked about the movement's work in East Harlem.
Bueno, nosotros siempre luchamos por vivienda digna y luchamos porque los inquilinos, los miembros de los edificios tengan agua caliente, que eso es lo más importante, agua caliente, la calefacción. Siempre estamos en una campaña contra hogares helados, así le llamamos. Eso es lo más importante que estamos haciendo.
So we're always fighting for dignified housing. In the winter, we have our campaign where we help tenants to get there, to organize themselves to get heat and hot water. And that's what we call our campaign against frozen homes, and that's most important for us right now.
¿Los inmigrantes están involucrados en este movimiento también?
Sí, sí. La mayoría de los miembros del movimiento son inmigrantes. El 90% somos inmigrantes todos.
Sí. The majority of the people who are involved in Movement for Justice in El Barrio, we are immigrants. I would say 90% of us are immigrants.
¿Crees que el temor de ser deportado afecta en su participación en el movimiento?
No. No afecta para nada porque somos valientes y somos positivos. Pensamos que cuando luchamos no tenemos nada que perder y sí mucho que ganar.
No, we're very brave, and we know we need to fight, and we think that if we fight, we don't have anything to lose, and we have a lot to gain.
Although Movement for Justice in El Barrio's members are in New York, that doesn't mean they have forgotten their roots. Last year, they successfully waged an international campaign to free 10 political prisoners in Chiapas, who were detained after defending their land from tourism development. NACLA covered this story in an article from the latest NACLA report on the Americas by multimedia journalist Andalusia Knoll.
Papers, no beer! Immigration marching here, no papers, no beer! Immigration marching here, no papers!
On December 3rd last year, Occupy Birmingham led a demonstration at the Etowah County Detention Center in Gladstone, Alabama, to protest the crackdown on immigrants across the state. The state has also adopted the Federal Immigration Customs Enforcement Detention Program, or ICE, whereby undocumented immigrants are detained for not having the proper documentation during routine traffic violations. Last year, Alabama passed state law HB 56, considered the harshest anti-immigrant law in the nation. According to HB 56, contracts made with undocumented immigrants are null and void. Public schools are required to document the immigration status of students. Landlords are prohibited from renting property to undocumented immigrants, who are also banned from receiving any public benefits or attending public colleges or universities. To get a sense of how the Occupy movement in Alabama has taken on the issue of immigration and is standing up to the detention of immigrants and HB 56, we spoke with Eric Forsyth of Occupy Birmingham on March 10th.
Well, obviously HB 56 was the catalyst. It's just, you know, a very pressing issue. Originally, I think, with Occupy movements all over, they were largely focused on financial issues, you know, bank bailouts and TARP reform and campaign finance, things like this. But I think what it helped do is tap into a larger community of people that have been waiting for a long time to become citizens, and I think re-engage them in grassroots political discussion. I wanted to take a stance on this issue to make Occupy Birmingham not just fixated on really specific financial issues, and we wanted to talk about some of the cultural problems that we saw happening here.
Occupy Birmingham is at the forefront of a national protest coming up on April the 14th that you've called Icebreaker. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
But the idea for Icebreaker is basically a threefold project. Number one, the idea of, the plan word there, Icebreaker, ice detention, but also this sense of breaking the ice with other community groups. Now, because of HB 56 and our kind of necessity to join together to fight this, Alabama has got a unique position where our Occupy people are really ingrained on this issue. They know what's going on. That we've created these coalitions, but other Occupies may not. I mean, obviously, places like Arizona, California, where these issues are a little more salient, you have that. But so what we want to do is try to make this issue one that's part of the Occupy discussion, and that people understand its connection to, the financial concerns that they may have, but also to this larger cultural issue, and use this as an opportunity for us to join together. As people were saying at the march, Blanco, Negro, Latino, this is todos somos americanos, and the idea we're all American. Because when we take we just focus on this idea of these really regressive state laws, I think we missed some of the issue there, which is the South could, I think, speak to the rest of the country, because we've seen this in our history before. You get a Voting Rights Act passed, or you get a Civil Rights Act passed, and what are you left with 30 years if you still have a divided community? You can get these legal impediments taken down, but then you still, underneath it all, have a culture that is not working together, that doesn't see themselves as a community, that still largely is adversarial. And I think with the black-white issues here in Alabama, we've seen that happen. Even with all the successes of the civil rights struggle, we still see huge disparities in income and things like incarceration, capital punishment. And what I'm seeing is a danger of that happening again here. We focus too much on the politics of it, too much on the really short-term political game. And so what we want to do with Icebreaker is actually start bringing these communities together to build more than coalitions, but to build communities. And then the third component, of course, is this bigger discussion, the idea of comprehensive immigration reform. Even if we repeal HB 56 and SB 1070 in Arizona, or these other laws that are sprouting up, we still got a huge problem of this federal policy that, even the so-called liberal Democrats have, deported over 1 million people in 3 years. That's an issue that needs to be part of the discussion. And right now, I think that issue is kind of being swept under the rug, so we can, talk about the really backward Alabama and Georgia and South Carolina legislatures. Those are easy things for people to pick on. But I think what that largely leaves untouched are these big federal programs and these cultural issues. So I'm hoping that Icebreaker, if we can position it right, will be, a national initiative to start to deal with these other things as well.
This year, NACLA is celebrating our 45th anniversary. In honor of this historic moment, we have redesigned the NACLA Report in the Americas, and we're moving to a quarterly schedule. The new magazine has nearly double the page count, includes a full color section, and more reviews from books and documentaries. The new schedule also enables us to publish more multimedia with videos, interviews, web articles, audio, and podcasts like this. Also in commemoration of our 45-year history, we are holding an anniversary gala on May 10th. At the event, we'll be honoring Noam Chomsky, the founder of Mexico's Movement for Peace with Justice and Dignity, Javier Sicilia, and Mexican artist Eduardo del Rio Rios. Tickets are still available. You can visit NACLA.org for more information. The music from today's podcast is from musician Gustavo Lozano from the U.S.-Mexico border. Lozano's music focuses on themes that affect us and unite us in the fight for social justice. Tim Russo's news report from Honduras is courtesy of the half-hour daily radio news program Free Speech Radio News. You can hear their daily broadcast at fsrn.org. For more information on Jenny Atlee's Honduras Accompaniment Project or to join a delegation to Honduras, visit friendshipamericas.org. And that's all for now from our Spring 2012 NACLA podcast. Please stay tuned, and we'll be bringing you more from NACLA Radio in the coming weeks. To read NACLA's latest issue or to check out our archive, blogs, and multimedia, go to NACLA.org. And don't forget, NACLA can always use your support. You can donate or subscribe at NACLA.org. From New York, this is Michael Fox,
Alexandra Hall,
and Amber Rosenau
for NACLA Radio.